This is Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. This week, novelist Jennifer Haig tells us about Rabbit Moon, her atmospheric and emotionally complex novel set in Shanghai, China. It follows an estranged American family reuniting after a tragedy and a daughter living a secret life abroad. Then L. Annette Binder returns to the show to discuss Child of Earth and Starry Heaven, her deeply moving memoir of caring for her mother through Alzheimer's. It's a story of love, loss, and learning to live fully in the present. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Jennifer Haig is one of my favorite novelists. She's been a guest on Writer's Voice quite a few times over the 20 years we've been doing the show. Haig writes emotionally complex novels with deeply drawn, compelling characters, often taking on issues of the injuries of class and gender in America in a way that's never preachy and always riveting. Her newest novel, Rabbit Moon, breaks the mold a bit, still riveting, but it's the first of her novels to take place abroad, in China, a place Haig had never been before spending several months in a writer's residency in Shanghai. The story features a young American woman who's fled the family home for China after a traumatic relationship with an older man fractures her family. Her life in Shanghai harbors a secret she's unwilling to share with anyone back home. But something terrible happens to her that forces her family together to deal with traumas past and present. I spoke with Jennifer Haig last week. Let's listen to that conversation now. Jennifer Haig, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. It's good to be back.
This terrific novel, Rabbit Moon, is very different from your other novels. One way in which it's different is that it takes place in China. I believe almost all of your previous novels have taken place in the U.S.
Yes, all of them, in fact. So this is book number 8, and it has been a whole other experience for me. We've talked many times about my earlier book, so you know that about half my books are set in Western Pennsylvania, where I grew up, and the other half are set in Boston, where I've lived my whole adult life. So this book is neither. This is a whole other thing. It's a book that caught me by surprise. So what happened was I was working on an earlier book, Mercy Street, when I got a fellowship to go to China for 3 months. So I had these 3 months in Shanghai with no responsibilities, lots of time to write. And yet I found that when I got there, I couldn't even remember what Boston looked like. Like there was absolutely no possibility for me to continue working on a Boston novel because the experience of being in China, my first time there, was so overwhelming, so, you know, exhilarating, but also invasive in a way. It was not an experience you could block out. And I didn't want to. I wanted to fully experience being in this very different place. And I found that the only way I was going to do any writing while I was there was to write about what was around me, because it was so interesting and so unlike anywhere I knew. And the whole experience of being there kind of lit up my brain. So that was the genesis of this book.
Do you speak Chinese?
I don't. And in fact, this experience of being isolated by language was really interesting for me. I'm really good at languages. You know, I speak several European languages fairly fluently. I'm good at picking up language, but to pick up Mandarin as an adult is really, really difficult. And certainly you'd need a lot more than 3 months. So I realized very quickly that the language around me kind of sealed me off. And it's the longest I had ever spent in a place where I knew none of the language. So one surprising result of this was that for the first time in my life, I was able to write in public spaces. I am not that writer who sits in a cafe with my latte and scribbles pages. I actually hate those people because I feel that they have access to more of the world while they're working. And I am simply unable to do that normally. I work in a writing space that's separate from my house. It's a silent room in a quiet building. I go there every day. I wear earplugs, over which I wear those earmuffs that construction workers wear. This is a tip from my friend Andre Debuse, who wears them also. So that's how insulated I normally am from my surroundings when I'm writing. But being in China, that language was so impenetrable that I found I could be that writer sitting in a cafe with a latte. So that's what I did. I went out into the city every day, sat in a tea house or a public park or a train station or a restaurant, and wrote about the characters in my head and also about the life that was happening all around me. So it was an entirely different writing process, and I feel led to an entirely different kind of book.
Yet you really seem to understand and describe with such, well, I haven't been to China, but what felt like verisimilitude to so much of the culture and the interactions. I mean, you have some very important Chinese characters, not just American characters. How difficult was it to do that? How did you manage that?
There was only one way to do it, and that was to write about clueless Americans like myself. I mean, I could in no way have faked the understanding a native would have of Shanghai. There's no way. So this is very much a novel about the experience of being out of your depth, being overwhelmed, being somewhat mystified by your surroundings, and trying to find your way. So the characters in this novel, it really focuses on one family. It's a sort of fractured American family whose adult daughter, Lindsay, has dropped out of college and gone for a year ostensibly to teach English in Beijing. That's what her parents believe until they get this phone call, and this is not a spoiler because it happens very early in the book. Her mother gets a phone call at midnight saying her daughter's been hit by a car in China. And so she does what any parent would do. She gets on a plane to China. So Claire, her mother, arrives in Shanghai, never having been to China, completely disoriented and also in a mad panic because her daughter's been hit by a car and she has no further details. So that's where the story begins. As a novelist, I always feel that a novel begins with the moment after which nothing will ever be the same. And in the case of Rabbit Moon, it's very clear what that moment is. It's this terrible hit and run accident. So that is the genesis of the story. So Lindsay's mother arrives in China separately. Her father also arrives. Her parents are acrimoniously divorced. They really haven't had to deal with each other since the divorce. And there's a whole lot of unspoken resentment between the two of them. So here they are, these ex-spouses, both in an Asian megacity for the first time, both scared to death what's happening to their daughter, unable to communicate with anyone around them except each other. So that's the setup for the story.
Yeah, that's a great setup. Now, you haven't really talked much about her sister Grace, and she's also a critical element of this story, at least from Lindsay's point of view.
Yes, so she is the fourth member of the family, and she's the only one who's off stage at the beginning of the novel. So Lindsay's had this accident in China. Her parents have flown over to see what's happened, and their much younger daughter, Grace, is parked at summer camp in New Hampshire. So she and Lindsay are very close, but there's a big age difference between these two sisters. Lindsay's 22, Grace is only 11. The other crucial fact is that Grace, the younger sister, has been adopted. She was adopted as an infant from China. And this is really crucial to the story because that was the origin of Lindsay's own fascination with China and why she eventually did want to go to China to teach English, why she has learned the Chinese language. It was the beginning of her kind of lifelong love affair with China, was adopting this much younger sister. Grace, the adopted Chinese sister, shares none of this fascination with China. In fact, She doesn't want to hear about it. Her parents have been very, conscientious about making sure she has a Chinese language tutor. Well, that didn't fly. Grace doesn't want to learn Chinese. She's not interested in calligraphy lessons or Chinese dance lessons. So all her adoptive parents' attempts to introduce her to her culture of origin have fallen completely flat. She wants nothing to do with it. So it's her older sister who's actually interested in China. The other thing I should say about this family is Lindsay is pretty much estranged from her parents when the novel opens, and her little sister is the only family member she stays in close touch with. So Lindsay and Grace are constantly texting, even after Lindsay has moved to China. And Lindsay, exchanges an email with her parents once in a blue moon, maybe, but she really tells them nothing.
Without giving anything too much away, I'd like to ask about Lindsay becoming an escort in Shanghai. Is that okay?
Yeah, it's okay. So the other crucial fact about Lindsay is that she lies to her parents all the time. It's an easy to do because her parents are so very far away. They're on the other side of the world. They're barely in touch. As far as her parents know, she's still teaching English in Beijing. In point of fact, she stopped teaching English a year ago and moved from Beijing to Shanghai, which is a big move. It's like moving from Boston to Chicago without mentioning this fact to her parents. So she's moved across China. She's taken a different job and is living something of a secret life. So Lindsay's parents are operating on old information. They don't even know she's in Shanghai until they get the call that she's been hit by a car there. So this is completely mystifying to her parents. When did she move? Why did she move? What is she doing there? What's going on in their daughter's life? They really have no idea.
And what is going on in her life is that she's become an escort in Shanghai.
Yeah. The other, I think, crucial fact about Lindsay is that she's a polyglot. She's really good at learning languages. She's been learning languages her whole life, and she, in fact, does speak Chinese. She's the character with the superpower I was wishing I had during my months in Shanghai. I would have loved nothing more than be able to speak with the people around me, but I couldn't. So I invented this character, this young American woman who did have this ability, in part because she started learning Chinese as a very young person. Her little sister had no interest in the language tutor, so Lindsay said, "Okay, I'll learn Chinese," and has made a concerted effort at this, both in school and with a private tutor. So her Chinese is quite good when she comes to Beijing to teach English, and then it gets better. So part of her experience in Shanghai working as an escort is that she can interact with clients who are Chinese speaking, who are English speaking, who are French or Spanish speaking. She's really equally adept in all these languages, and that has been part of her niche as an escort.
It seemed to me that she enjoys being an escort, and she, in fact, falls in love with one of her clients. And it almost seems like a natural fit for her. And I struggled with this at first.
Well, Francesca, I wouldn't say she exactly enjoys it, and I wouldn't say she exactly falls in love. It's far more complex than all of that. Lindsay, is a character whose life has kind of taken a turn long before she came to China. There was another moment in her past after which nothing has been the same. When she was 16 years old, she got into a sexual relationship with a much older man, a friend of her parents, a married man with a child. And this has really messed with her. This is really a moment that has changed who she was and has changed the story of her life. And so a lot of the decisions she has made since have been an outgrowth of this really traumatic experience she had as a young person. So even this choice to be an escort and her way of interacting with men in, I guess we'll call it, a professional context, even that has been so shaped by this early experience she had, this really damaging relationship with a man who was far too old for her. So she's a character who's acting out of needs that she doesn't completely understand, and the results are not great. So it's a complicated set of choices that has landed her where she is.
Well, exactly. And this is exactly what happened to me. You know, at first, my reaction to her was that she's enjoying being an escort. Why is Jennifer Haig writing about this? The last book was Mercy Street, which was about an abortion clinic and came from a feminist perspective. And it seems like it's such a trope, that trope of young women becoming escorts in movies and books, largely written by men. And then, because I enjoy your writing so much, I had to say to myself, okay, let me look at this judgment that I'm struggling with here. Why do I have it? Why am I judging an escort? And why is she, in fact, looking at being an escort as representing some kind of freedom on the one hand, but she's also losing her freedom on the other? And so it forced me to think more deeply about this character and why she finds herself in this place. And then it made me actually feel like I understood much more. And what you just said confirms that for me, because it made me think about that earlier encounter and how that kind of abuse does, in fact, that kind of relationship does, in fact, distort women's lives. Girls who have been through that kind of experience, and there are many of them, it just distorts relationships with people beyond that.
For sure. And you know, as you say, it is a very, very common experience. Even in the Me Too age, it remains a very common experience. And in Lindsay's case, it's complicated by the fact that she is physically stunning. And you know, there is a moment early in the novel where Claire's come to the Chinese hospital to see her daughter after the accident. And she's thinking her daughter is beautiful, the best and worst thing that can happen to a girl. And as you see kind of Lindsay's history and see how her story has played out, you see that being beautiful has not been all that great for her in many ways. She's one of these girls who is such a almost a freak of nature. She's such a very beautiful, very young girl that nobody can interact with her as a regular kid, as a regular girl, as a regular young woman. It's just not possible for people to see past her appearance. And her mother has this thought about her as the kind of beauty that makes a girl a target. And in fact, had Lindsay been just an ordinary looking girl, a lot of the very damaging things that happened to her at a young age would not have happened. And so this odd experience of growing up in a body that is, for reasons that have nothing to do with you, a kind of cultural ideal, she's in many ways a victim of it. Lindsay herself is. And you know, it has affected the way she sees herself, the way she assesses her own value. And it's a very hard thing for a young person to make sense of. Like there's a memory Claire has of being in an airport with Lindsay when Lindsay was very young, 14 years old, and some guy comes up and gives her a business card and says, "Does your daughter have headshots?" And Claire says, "She's 14." Like this is just this kind of commodification of female beauty, very young female beauty. It's something her mother is so aware of and so concerned about. And she's not wrong. And it really has played out in Lindsay's life in this very damaging way.
So, talk a little bit about her relationship to freedom that I just alluded to, because for her, being an escort means she's free because she's free of her family. She doesn't depend on them economically, but somebody else really owns her body.
Yes, completely. Okay, so this question of freedom, it is highly relevant to Lindsay. As you say, you know, she's 22 years old. Her idea of being free is leaving her parents behind, leaving her past behind, and separating herself from what she now views as mistakes she's made that have had, you know, negative consequences for other people, for her whole family. So part of her feeling of freedom is just being far away from all of that. But it's more than that. You know, I love writing about characters of this age. Lindsay is 22. Her best friend in Shanghai, a young man named Johnny Du, is about the same age. And a thing Lindsay and Johnny have in common is that they're both lying to their parents. They're both kind of living these double lives, experimenting with who they are and who they want to be, and withholding a great deal from their families. And that's part of the feeling of freedom of being young, too. And I remember that feeling extremely well, in particular, the kind of conflicted relationship Lindsay has with her mother, which I think is not so uncommon among mothers and daughters. Lindsay and Claire are really hard on each other, and it comes from both sides. They're judgmental about each other, they find fault with each other. Claire, like a lot of mothers, looks at her daughter's choices and is alarmed, and she wants Lindsay to learn from her own mistakes, as a lot of mothers do. She wants Lindsay to do better than she did and make better choices. And of course, it doesn't work that way. All daughters need to make their own mistakes and are often very resistant to learning from their mother's wrong turns. So that dynamic is complicated between the two of them. Lindsay's also very judgmental of her mother in a particular way that a lot of young people can be, and that I myself was when I was around Lindsay's age. I think back on my own family. My mother was a terrific parent. She was very involved. She did most of the heavy lifting. My dad was okay. I mean, I loved my dad. He's a wonderful guy, but parenting was a small part of his life, and it was a large part of my mother's life. And it's sort of a traditional family dynamic that also exists in Lindsay's family. And she also kind of gives her father a pass and holds her mother accountable for everything. So there is this kind of this tendency toward judgment, both on the mother side and the daughter side, that really complicates their relationship. And so part of the freedom Lindsay is chasing and thinks she finds in China is being outside that, being away from her mother's judgment. And just not having those conversations anymore.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. My guest is Jennifer Haig, and we're talking about her terrific new novel, Rabbit Moon. So, the drawing of the characters I find is so fine, even the minor characters. You just mentioned Johnny Dew. I wonder if you could talk about him.
Well, Johnny is probably the most of all the characters. He is probably the most central of the Chinese characters. And I wrote him from the outside, as I had to do. There was no way for me to fake the knowledge of that culture that Johnny has. So I didn't try to do that. You see, Johnny mostly in his relationship with Lindsay, who is his best friend. Johnny is very much modeled on a guy I used to see every day, my time in China. So, a little bit about this fellowship. I was one of 10 international writers who were there as a guest of the Shanghai Writers Association. And so, there were 10 of us from different countries. There was a Spanish writer and a Polish writer, an Argentinian writer, and a Russian writer. We were all from different countries. We were all staying in the same building, this tall apartment tower. And like many buildings in China, it had on every floor a mix of commercial spaces and apartments. So I was on the 23rd floor. I was two doors down from a hair salon. And I became very fascinated with the comings and goings of people from this salon. There was one young man who worked there. I saw him every day in the elevator, smoking cigarettes on the sidewalk outside. A very young, very beautiful, sort of androgynous looking Chinese man who worked as a hairstylist. Had I met him under different circumstances, I would have contrived some way to have a conversation with this guy and just find out who is he, where did he come from. But because of the language barrier, I wasn't able to do that. So for the first time in my life as a writer, really, I had to go purely on imagination and observation. And I found that to be oddly thrilling. Normally, I err on the side of doing too much research. In writing this book, I simply couldn't. So this book it's close observation and imagination, and the developing of Johnny, the Johnny Duke character, very much proceeded in that way. I'll never know whether my imagined version of this guy's life comes anywhere close to the reality of this stranger I saw every day. And there's something haunting about that. I will simply never know. That was the longest I'd ever spent in a country where I simply did not speak the language. So it was this kind of deep loneliness that, perversely maybe, was very conducive to writing. I was so desperate to have a conversation that I had the conversation with the page. And that's really what writing is for me. It's having a conversation with a best friend you've never met, this reader who really does understand everything you're trying to communicate. So that was the experience of writing, being out in public every day, observing people, even if I couldn't talk to them, and kind of piercing through the loneliness in that way. So a number of these characters are suggested by people I simply saw, like Johnny Depp, and even like Lindsay herself, who in some way draws on young women I saw coming and going from this apartment building I was living in. Beautifully dressed young women, most of them Chinese, some of them not, who knocked on different doors every time they appeared. So my imagination of Lindsay's life is very much suggested by these young women I saw.
And you say in the acknowledgments that the months you spent in Shanghai changed you profoundly. How did they do that?
I think it made me question some of my assumptions about how I write and how writing works. You know, 8 books in, you sort of develop a methodology, this way of approaching a story. And it seems like it's written in stone, or it does to me. Like when I've set out to write a novel, here is what I do. The normal process for me is to spend 3 to 6 months on the front end, not writing the novel yet, but writing about the novel. So I'm writing little biographies of the characters. I'm writing detailed descriptions of all the locations where things happen. In this case, I didn't have the luxury of doing that. I didn't have 3 to 6 months to sort of clear my throat before I started writing. So I did it differently. I wrote in public. I wrote really, really fast. I wrote these very messy, fragmentary pieces of scenes, pieces of chapters that didn't really amount to anything. And when I left after 3 months, I had a whole pile of this stuff. When I got back to Boston, I didn't look at it. I put it down, I put it in a drawer. Simply because I had started this earlier book, Mercy Street, and it was under contract and I wanted to finish it. And so I went back to that other book and it took far longer than I would have thought possible, which is always the case with a novel. And so by the time I got back to these pages I'd written in Shanghai, nearly 5 years had passed. And I'd never done that before. And if you'd asked me at the time, I would have thought there's no way I'm going to look at these pages and see anything of value in them. It's going to feel completely over. I'm going to feel very distant from them, and I won't be inspired to finish it. That was my expectation. To my surprise, that's not what happened. I looked at those pages I'd written nearly 5 years earlier, and it was very clear to me exactly what I needed to do. I saw exactly what was missing, where the holes were, where the wrong turns were, what scenes yet remained to be written, where the story needed to go. I had this kind of crazy clarity I've never had before because I've never put something down long enough to get it. I found in this case, I could read those pages almost as if they had been written by someone else, which I never would have believed was possible until I did that. So that was really illuminating to me, that all my rules about how I write and what I can do and what I can't do are self-imposed to some degree. And it's, I think, a very healthy thing to test some of those assumptions periodically. And so I tested them in a radical way in the writing of this book.
Well, it really works so well. It's such a terrific book. Rabbit Moon, Jennifer Haig, thank you so much for talking with us about this book. I just totally loved it.
Thank you, Francesca.
Jennifer Haig. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to our other conversations with Haig through the years. Next up, a moving memoir of a mother's descent into Alzheimer's disease. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. It's the fear that haunts many a family, a loved one or oneself getting Alzheimer's disease. the prevalence of Alzheimer's is projected to increase significantly in the coming decades. By 2050, the number in the U.S. is predicted to rise to nearly 13 million, according to the Alzheimer's Association. This nearly doubles the current number. When novelist Elinette Binder's beloved mother began to exhibit signs of dementia, Binder not only took on making sure her mother's needs were taken care of, she also began chronicling her mother's decline and her own reactions to it. In the resulting memoir, Child of Earth and Starry Heaven, Binder recounts her mother's journey through Alzheimer's and her own emotional and spiritual awakening during that time. Drawing on classical texts, cultural history, and personal caregiving, her memoir explores grief, presence, and the enduring mystery of consciousness. Let's hear my conversation with Elinette Binder now. Elinette Binder, welcome to Writer's Voice. Actually, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much, Francesca.
The last time we spoke with you, it was about your wonderful novel, The Vanishing Sky. This is a memoir, Child of Earth and Starry Heaven. It's a memoir of your mother's decline into Alzheimer's disease, and it's a kind of spiritual journey, I would say, also for you. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, watching her struggle with dementia raised so many big questions for me and really made me explore some of the things that I'd studied before and sort of taken for granted. And yes, absolutely. It was a journey of spiritual growth for me as well.
And say something about the title.
Yes, I was a classics major in college, so I studied Latin and ancient Greek. And Child of Earth and Starry Heaven is from the ancient Greek. The Greeks believed that, generally speaking, when you die, you drink from the river of forgetfulness, from Lethe, and thus released from all the sort of the memories of life, and you're sort of free then to be a shade in the underworld. But for the devotees of Orpheus in the ancient world, they had a different approach to the release of memories after death, and they actually recommended that you drink from the lake of memory instead. And so some of them would carry little scrolls that they would wear sort of as pendants to remind them of what to say to the guardians of the underworld when they finally got there, so that they would remember not to drink from the river of forgetfulness, but instead to drink from the lake of memory. And so they were instructed to say, "I am a child of earth and starry heaven, but descended from heaven. You yourselves know this. I am parched with thirst and dying quickly. Give me the cool water flowing from memory's lake." And so that really struck me as I was thinking about both the classics that I'd studied in my youth and then watching my mother's struggle and sort of the big questions that it raised for me about consciousness, and that sort of image of the choice between remembering, even when remembering might be painful, or forgetting and sort of embracing oblivion, that really came to a head for me as I watched my mother decline.
And before we get into the book itself, well, this is part of the book itself, actually, I would love to have you read your poem that you composed. It's at the beginning of the book, and it has no title.
Gladly. Storms gather in your eye, gather and recede, and forgetting blooms in the space they leave. The heart is just a muscle. I tell myself every time I come to visit. It beats and beats until it doesn't. Electrical charges is all we are. I tell myself this too. Simple charges bridging those dark spaces. And they fade like stars. They fail like all stars must, collapsing inward and breaking into their elements. But nothing can explain the manner of your departure. Tangles and plaques, the doctors say. It's a matter of cascading failures. But doctors are blind to the tides, the ebb and flow of awareness, and the hope that blooms with it, only to wither.
What strange attraction steals you from this world? What ocean sway against the pool of what strange moon?
It's a beautiful poem, and listening to you read it made me also realize how much of the book itself is contained within that poem.
Yeah, that's true.
Say a little more about that.
It captures the ebbs and flows, the sort of waxing and waning of her cognition, and how it would raise my hopes only to dash them the next time I came to visit. But how I also got sustenance from the good days. You know, they always say there's good days and there's bad days. But those good days gave me sustenance and sort of helped me through the bad days that inevitably followed. I think also the sense that there's so much that doctors know, but there's even more that they don't know, especially about dementia. You know, you have the brightest minds working so hard trying to figure out what's causing cognitive failure. And so far, they just haven't had much luck. And so I think there's also that sense of frustration that I felt of, isn't there something that we can do? I mean, she's healthy in every other way. She took such good care of herself and walked and exercised, you know, and so it captures all of that, I think, the mystery of it.
Before we talk about your mother's dementia, tell us a little bit about her before she got dementia.
Oh, goodness. I have never met a more self-reliant, resilient person. She wore lipstick to shovel the snow. She cleaned out her rain gutters well into her 70s, climbing on the ladder. And she'd call me, you know, when I lived out east and say, oh, I'm going up on the ladder. And I would worry, but I knew there was no talking her out of it. She changed her own oil on her 74 Chevy Nova, because the fellows at Jiffy Lube were a little sloppy for her tastes. She loved animals and loved children. She was very proper and very organized, but she had a soft spot for dogs in particular and always had a milk bone or two in her purse. But she also had a lot of eccentricities, and I think those eccentricities in particular made it easier for me to go into denial about what was happening with her cognition. No ATM card ever, because she didn't trust machines to sort of distribute her money. Very dodgy, very iffy about the very idea of credit cards, you know? And so I think there were certain technological challenges for her that made it very easy for me to overlook what was happening once it began.
Yeah, you say that your realization that she had dementia, and actually she had Alzheimer's disease, took years actually to understand the signs. When did you realize, and how did you realize, that she did have dementia?
It became pretty clear when she stopped taking her diabetes medicine, because she was so disciplined about her diabetes that she was able to manage her blood sugar without insulin for decades. And she went to one appointment, everything was looking great. 6 months later, her numbers were completely out of whack. And so she took me into her closet where all the bottles were just lined up like little chess pieces, and they were all full. And she had years worth of them. And as I began to realize, oh my goodness, she stopped taking her medicine, and that's why everything's out of whack. And so I thought, well, let me get her one of those weekly pill organizers. And so I sorted everything into the weekly pill organizer. And when I left that day, I said, okay, now, you know, when it's time, take the next day's worth of pills. And so when I went to see her the next day, I realized with an absolute jolt that she'd taken the whole week's worth of pills. And it became clear to me at that point that something organic was happening. It wasn't just eccentricity anymore. It wasn't just, you know, maybe getting a little bit laxer as she got older, that something was actually going on with her cognitively.
And how aware do you think she was, at least in the beginnings of her decline, that she had problems?
You know, I think she was aware that something was off, but I think she framed it in terms of her diabetes. And so she'd say, well, I can't really drive anymore because my blood sugar, it might drop really suddenly, or it might spike. And so I think she knew something wasn't right, but I'm not sure she ever really put it together that it was Alzheimer's. And I found that to be a blessing for her, honestly. You know, I think about half of patients don't realize that they have a cognitive decline. And so I think my mother fell into that group, and I was grateful for it because for her, she told me multiple times during her younger years, there's nothing worse. She would go visit friends of hers who were in memory care long after their families had stopped visiting in some cases. And she would come back and she would just say, anything but that, anything but that. And so when I realized it was happening to her, but she stayed remarkably content through most of it, I was just incredibly grateful for that.
And one thing that really struck me is what a good daughter you were. You really took good care of your mom. Talk a little bit about that process. I mean, it seems that you were pretty lucky in finding some good places for her.
Incredibly lucky. And thank you for your kind words. I mean, I tried, and there are so many shortcomings that I see in myself, as a person and as a daughter. I wish I could have done more, but I definitely tried to spend as much time with her as possible throughout the, before she ever had cognitive decline, and then certainly once it began. We were incredibly lucky to find good places. I was really hoping that she could stay with us, and it became clear that that was just not going to work. We didn't have a guest room on the main floor. We didn't even have a full bathroom on the main floor, and navigating stairs was going to be too hard, and we weren't going to be able to add on anything to the house. We were working on a much tighter timeline than I had ever imagined. So we started looking around here locally in the Upper Valley of New Hampshire, and we're just really blessed to find two places. She was in two different facilities. And the second one in particular, we were just so lucky because the people there were lovely. The residents, it really felt like a cocoon. And so I spent many hours there just about every day. And I just was grateful the entire time that we were lucky like this.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. My guest is Annette Binder, and we're talking about her moving memoir of caring for her mother after an Alzheimer's diagnosis. The memoir is called Child of Earth and Starry Heaven. So you struggled to find a cure. Of course, we don't have a cure. You say you spent your evenings looking for a miracle. What were some of the things you were looking into, and where are we right now with understanding Alzheimer's disease?
I spent many evenings looking at everything from supplements that might be helpful, exercise, which we definitely tried. We found a personal trainer that worked with my mom a couple of times a week. Who specialized in working with the elderly. And then I also took her on walks around our neighborhood. And then I found some MIT studies about the possible beneficial effect of 40 hertz frequency clicks and also flashing lights. And so I tried that. And, there might well be something to both of those, but I think at the point that we tried it with my mom, for whatever reason, she might have been, her cognitive decline might have been too far advanced, or maybe it just wasn't going to work for her. But we certainly didn't notice any improvement or any even a slowing down of her decline. Her decline was precipitous, and when I compared it to other neighbors in her different residences where she lived, it always struck me as being relatively steep compared to her neighbors for whatever reason. So yes, I think we definitely looked, spent many hours looking, and I think there's still, you read just about every other day about possible advances being made, but so far, I don't think we've really gotten there yet. When I spoke to a neurologist after my mother's passing, who looked at her scans with me, and was nice enough to walk me through what he saw, I asked him, would it have helped if she'd gone on some clinical trials and tried medicines and really aggressively tried to treat it? And he said, not yet. I'm afraid not yet. I think we might be on the cusp of something, but not yet.
Different cultures have thought of dementia in different ways. And you write about this, Annette Binder, in this wonderful book, Child of Earth and Starry Heaven. Tell us about some of the different ways different cultures have thought about dementia, and include in that the indigenous peoples of the Americas.
Well, I started because my background was in classics. I started with the Romans and the Greeks and then went out from there. And Cicero, the Roman orator, had a very definite, a very modern almost view of old age, where he basically said, you have to be steadfast, you have to be moderate, you have to exercise and have a moderate diet and protect your cognition by working your brain. And if you do that, you will avoid the difficulties of memory loss. You will stay a vigorous, sort of vibrant thinking person. And so in so many ways, Cicero, who lived, 2,000 years ago, more than 2,000 years ago, is so modern. I found it stunning. But then you had another group of ancients who really believed it was inevitable. It was just the sort of the third age of man. You sort of have this age of vitality and cognitive sort of vibrance, and it's bookended by your sort of child years and by your older years, and those are the eras of dependence. That was sort of what I started with, and then I moved out from there. And the Chinese had a very definite idea that it was the result of an imbalance in your qi, in your energy. People from India had a similar sort of approach and called it kitanasa, which was also sort of not just a loss of mental acuity, but a loss of heart. It was really centered in the heart. So I think, the approaches have varied so much, and it's been for thousands of years. And the same is true with the indigenous approaches, loss of heart, that I think it really it's so modern. The debate is so modern. Is it inevitable, or is it something that can be warded off with exercise and taking classes? And I mean, those debates are going on now, and they have been going on for millennia.
I found very affecting the way you seem to move back and forth. There were times when you really focus on the losses, and other times when you focus on the beauty or the gifts.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there were so many moments of despair during my time on the memory care floor with my mother. Just utter despair when she, days when she didn't recognize my face, or at least appeared not to recognize my face. Luckily, those were relatively few. But there were also moments of gratitude, and even moments of grace on that second floor memory care unit. And I don't mean the sort of easy gratitude of saying, oh, well, I have so much personally to be grateful for. Look at my daughter, look at my husband. That's not what I mean. I mean, there were actually moments of gratitude just watching people living their lives on the memory care unit, because it was so easy to fall into life and the rhythms of life on that floor. And to see the affection that people still felt and how much love they still had in their hearts and how often they were still really present. I mean, everyone had bad days, things ebbed and flowed. There was that waxing and that waning. But at their core, my mother, I still felt very strongly, was there. When I looked in her eyes, she was my mother. And yes, she was having cognitive issues and something was happening in her brain, but I felt like her consciousness remained intact and accessible on many, many occasions. And so I just saw a lot of things to be grateful for, small moments of affection and kindness, the beauty of, family members coming and caring for their loved ones and just sitting with them and having a simple meal. Because I think, especially near the end, my mother didn't talk about the past anymore. And she certainly didn't think about the future. So what she had and what I had with her was just that moment in time. And I was so incredibly grateful for that. And I guess what it taught me is we sort of fool ourselves into thinking of and planning for the future. And that's a good thing, I suppose, because otherwise our lives would be very disjointed. And we dwell a lot on the past, or at least I do. But really what we have, and the only thing we have, is ever what we have right at this exact moment. And so I guess spending so much time with my mom, especially near the end, taught me to cherish that present moment, just to be there for that moment and be grateful for it. Even if it's just as simple as having a popsicle together, it's something that I'm so grateful for and that I try to carry with me now.
I mean, right there is a spiritual lesson to be in the moment, like practical Zen.
Yes, absolutely. And it's easy to read about that, but you actually have to live it. If your loved one has a disease like Alzheimer's or one of the dementias, you really have to live it, because otherwise, it's easy to sort of say it in the abstract, but all you really have is that moment, because that's what they have. Every dessert is just, I think I say surpassingly sweet, because they are just lingering on their dessert and enjoying it. And how could you not want to do the same with them? We're not promised tomorrow, but we certainly have our pie at the moment, and we're going to enjoy it together. So yes, absolutely. I think it was life altering in so many ways.
My mother didn't have Alzheimer's, but she had what they call mild cognitive impairment, which is really not so mild. She would get paranoid. She had sundowner's syndrome. She lost the ability to use a telephone. But she could also have completely lucid conversations for quite some time. It did ebb and flow a lot. But one of the questions I struggled with, and I think I actually struggled with more after my mother's death because I wondered if I had done the right thing. I wondered if I should have lied to her more. I mean, my tendency was to always try to orient her to what was really going on. And that was more my own need, I think, for her to be lucid than her need, Talk a little bit about that. You say on the memory care unit where your mother was living, the aides didn't contradict people. They did lie to people quite easily to kind of ease their anxieties.
Yes, I think about some things, absolutely. We'd have people waiting for the train. And I think it was really a matter of just easing their anxieties and deflection. So I think they tried to keep the lies to a minimum, but sometimes it's inevitable, but it's more deflection. I'll sit here and wait with you and then guide the conversation somewhere else. Because I think really what mattered to me was keeping my mom content and feeling the love that I had for her, and so I think anything that I could do to keep her content, but not lie about things like medicine or doctor's visits or things like that. But it was a really hard balance to strike, because I don't like to lie. And you can't really easily correct someone. You can't really say, if someone wants to pay for their meal, you can't say, well, no, you're in memory care and the meals are covered. That would just be unthinkable for me to say, so you find ways to deflect and then change the topic and keep the conversation going, keep that connection going. But it's such a hard thing, because you don't want to lie, or you don't want to lie any more than absolutely necessary. You don't want to wound the person with the truth, but you also don't want to layer lie upon lie. And that is such a hard balance to strike.
You also mentioned the phenomenon of people with dementia becoming cognitively clear, totally clear, just before they die. And I just mentioned that my mother also would move back and forth between lucidity and confusion. What does this really mean then? If people can, in fact, recapture their lucidity, what does that mean about the brain, about the mind? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that is a huge question. A scientist named Michael Naum has sort of looked at what he calls terminal lucidity, and other scientists call paradoxical lucidity, to try to understand what's going on there, because there are so many documented cases of that. And I think scientists are beginning to take it seriously now and look into it in a really disciplined way, trying to evaluate, is there some sort of chemical change that happens shortly before death, that might sort of unlock the memory sort of mechanism and the retrieval mechanism for people who are otherwise cognitively impaired. And so there are ongoing studies right now looking into what might be at play there. And one thing that Michael Naum in his study suggested is, well, there's a lot we don't really understand about the brain. There's people who lack the vast majority of their brain, actual physiologically, they lack the brain and yet are still able to function at a relatively high level, even though they lack the different lobes that might be necessary for what they're doing. And so, you know, the sort of idea of the brain versus the mind, that sort of duality, are we just our organic brain? Or is there some other ineffable sort of mind component to it, which leads into the question of the soul and of consciousness? And I think that is still so unresolved. You have Nobel Prize-winning neurologists and neuroscientists like Dr. Kandel at Columbia, who basically says we understand so much about the mechanics of memory building and how the cells on a cellular level, how they interact to relay information. But ask me why I like a red rose, and I can't answer it, because that's a question of consciousness. That's really, in some ways, the final frontier for neuroscientists and neurologists. And so I think terminal lucidity raises those questions in sort of boldface, you know, with like flashing lights, like what's going on there. And I'm hopeful that the ongoing studies might reveal some of that.
And finally, Annette Binder, you must have thought, what is coming up for me? Is this something that will happen to me as well? How did your experience with your mother not prepare you for what, because we don't know, but how did it create in you a sense of, all right, how would I deal with this if this happens with me, to me?
You know, in so many ways, strange as this might sound, I found it reassuring, because seeing my mother remain herself, albeit with cognitive decline, was reassuring to me. And so I think, you know, hopefully this won't happen to me in my future years. But, you know, if it does, in some ways, I found it reassuring to know that human kindness and sort of the love that I felt on that ward is something that might sustain me and my loved ones if we do have to go through that journey. And I guess the other thing that I learned is exactly what we were just talking about, which is I'm really trying to savor every moment now, because I want to live at that sort of heightened level. I want to keep that feeling of just really just enjoying the time that I have now, because nothing else is promised to me. And so I think those are the two things I carry with me, is that, you know, the love that my mom was capable of feeling and that I felt for her survived her cognitive decline. And I have some concrete tools now to sort of think about life, to think about the big questions, and to enjoy sort of my day-to-day life that I didn't have in quite the same way before.
So it's really a gift, your mother's final gift in some way to you.
I think that's absolutely right.
Well, the book is Child of Earth and Starry Heaven. It's beautifully written. It's profound. L. Annette Binder, thank you for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
L. Annette Binder. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to our conversation with her about her novel, The Vanishing Sky. L. Annette Binder. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to our conversation with her about her novel, The Vanishing Sky. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.